relief factor, pain relief that's natural, pain relief that works, and pain relief that attacks the source of the pain. That's the experience of tens of thousands of Americans who are taking Relief Factor right now. See their incredible video endorsements at ReliefFactor.com and then order your three-week quick starter pack for just $19.95. That's less than a dollar a day. Find out if it can work for you like it works for me by ordering your three-week quick starter pack today. ReliefFactor.com, ReliefFactor.com. Be the next success story.
Welcome, dear friends, to America First One-on-One with me, your host, Sebastian Gorka, former strategist to President Trump and member currently of the Defense Department's National Security Education Board. What does the word war mean? It has been grossly overused in the last few decades, the war on drugs, the war on poverty. For millions in Europe, it has another meaning, the original meaning. Let's listen to a man who understands what it means as he leads his nation against invaders. This is President Zelensky talking recently at the Grammys.
The war. What's more opposite to music? The silence of ruined cities and killed people. Our children draw swooping rockets, not shooting stars. Over 400 children have been injured and 153 children died. And we'll never see them drawing. Our burns are heavy. To wake up in the morning in bomb shelters, but alive. Our loved ones don't know if we will be together again. The war doesn't let us choose who survives and who stays in internal silence. Our musicians wear body armor instead of tuxedo. They sing to their wounded in hospitals.
Very, very solemn words there. What is the opposite of music, of celebrating music? It's having civilians and women and children under attack by a nation that has a record of doing that again and again and again. What is the latest from Ukraine? How far would it go? Let's talk to a man who knows, who's been covering it, and who has a very special qualification now as of this weekend. He's the Senior Vice President of the American Foreign Policy Council, Ilan Baman. Welcome to America First.
Oh, thanks, Sebastian. Good to be back.
So you've changed your bio on Twitter. There's a new line at the end of it.
There is. Sanctioned by Russia.
Ilan Baman, sanctioned by Russia.
Yeah, there quite a few of us have been, but...
I'm jealous now. I would like to be sanctioned. Okay, guys, put the tweet up on the screen. I received this from Ilan on Saturday. Quote, there's nothing quite like waking up on a Saturday morning and finding out you've been sanctioned by the Russian government. Quote, I finally made it, guys. Little old Ilan Baman, what did you do?
Well,
did you, like, take back the Crimea single-handedly? What did you do? Right.
Well, so as they say in business, you haven't really arrived until somebody sued you. So I feel like in politics, this is sort of a proof of concept that the work that I've been doing, you know, for years, and you and I have talked about this a lot, on Russian politics, Russian demographics, Russian neo-imperialism, you know, the right people are taking notice.
Okay, so you append a link in your tweet to the official document. Is your crime against the Kremlin listed there? What did you do specifically to get sanctioned, Ilan?
No, it's just...
You're just a bad guy. You're a
right,
naughty boy.
Me and, I think, 961 other people, including people like former Senator Orrin Hatch, former Senator John McCain, who are not with us anymore.
Hang on, they sanctioned dead people?
They did.
This is a real thing, right? This is not some Russian troll using the Russian official government website.
No, it's my sense is that it was cobbled together over the series of months, right? And
but McCain is.
But well,
how come we don't sanction dead people?
Close enough for government work.
Oh my gosh, should we sanction Khrushchev next? I mean, what would you do? Okay, I'm glad we could laugh about it because there are things of such enormity that. A little bit of humor is necessary, but seriously, I am a little bit jealous. Okay, so God bless you, and seriously, congratulations. If a murderous thug KGB colonel's government sanctions you, it's as Churchill told us, a man is measured by his enemies, and your estimation has gone up in my eyes even more than I thought it could. So congratulations.
Well,
okay.
Thank you.
So let's talk about what's happening. First, a kind of general observation I've been feeling for the last 2 or 3 weeks. Sadly, some predicted this, Ukraine is not in the front of the headlines as it used to be. Are we Are we really that short of attention span that Americans aren't adequately following this truly monumental story as closely as we should?
So I think that was always the fear that everybody had, which was that, you know, the longer the war dragged on, the more Western attention would waver. And the second part of it, which is the more worrisome part, is the more Western resolve will waver. Because what you're hearing now is more and more politicians in Europe, including politicians in the United States, talking about the fact that in order for the war to end, bring the Ukrainians to make compromises.
To negotiate,
essentially to relieve the pressure, to give Vladimir Putin a soft exit. And I actually think this is a really fascinating situation. The Russian military has blundered gloriously, right? This is a colossal military miscalculation.
Same number of casualties in 3 months as in 10 years in Afghanistan.
Exactly. And this is all at the feet of Vladimir Putin. And the worry now is this really paradoxical thing that we didn't think about 3 months ago, which is the Russians are losing so badly that there's really no graceful exit for Vladimir Putin.
And there's no way to save grace after what's actually happened in the last 3 months.
Exactly.
And also, if we can go back to Afghanistan, in Afghanistan, the pressure on the then Soviet regime took 7-8 years to build because there was no access to information. The conscripts' bodies were simply, you know, they died in training accidents.
That's right.
There was no, although social media is fatally compromised in the Soviet Union, but at least the deaths of conscripts are an issue a month in, not a decade in.
That's right. And this was always, you know, with the new media cycle, the new saturation with social media, any conflict like this has a much shorter shelf life, a sort of life cycle. It turns over very quickly.
Because the amount of information that's available.
Exactly. And because, quite frankly, the Ukrainians are winning the information war against the Russians.
I have to say, can I just interrupt you there? For a country, and we know it's got problems, and yes, we know there's corruption. I get it, guys, but it's still a free, independent country. Washington is corrupt. We don't think China invading would be a good thing either, okay? But for a country that is, let's say, backward in terms of civil society compared to Belgium or Switzerland, their information warfare has been stunningly good. I mean, the videos of Ukrainians, you know, of a peasant girl in traditional dress, with a dead Russian soldier at her feet. I, as somebody who worked in military intelligence in a Western army, I'm impressed, Ilan.
Yeah. No, and absolutely. And by the way, as you know, right, success begets success.
Yes.
And so the fact that the Ukrainians are doing well on the battlefield, the fact that they have things to report on and the Russians don't, really sort of elevates that imbalance. It amplifies the good news, the good job that they're doing with good news stories that they can actually tell and they can telegraph. And I think President Zelensky, in particular, right, in personifying the war, in showing a strong leader, a strong image of leadership, has been indispensable in keeping attention on the conflict in terms of Western audiences, in terms of media spectacles like the Grammys, where really there's no political thought other than correct political thought that's expressed. This is, I think, a very much a breath of fresh air.
And whilst there is, of course, you know, a huge amount of, you know, Russian bot activity and the standard kind of TASS, Izvestia propaganda line, there's a lack of sophistication, especially from the head of that country by comparison, who allegedly, you know, doesn't have a cell phone, doesn't use computers.
Well, and it's interesting also because what the Russians are doing and what the Russians are facing in terms of disinformation and media manipulation, it's a moving target. Because now the Russians have different problems. The Europeans have banded together. They've kicked out Russia Today, now known as RT. They've kicked out Sputnik.
Which is a state, let's be clear, a state broadcasting organ.
Absolutely. And they've kicked them out of being able to broadcast into the Eurozone. So the Russians have a whole demographic inside the European continent that they are having trouble messaging to. And they also have other strategic problems that they're trying to deal with. So the newest messaging campaign that the Russians have embarked on is to try to convince Swedish and Finnish publics that it's not a good idea for their countries to join NATO. And so that movement of disinformation, I think, is such a fascinating phenomenon.
Which likely, I mean, it's hard to say in warfare, which will likely do have the opposite effect and actually make Finns and Swedes even more committed to joining NATO.
Absolutely. And in part because the Ukrainian messaging has been so compelling and so arresting visually, because the Finns and the Swedes, I think, understand better than most people that they have. There's a bear at the door, and they need to stand together or fall separately.
Right. And the Finns, as my son asked me, what's the significance of the Finns joining NATO? I said, finally, we'll have some good snipers. Snipers who know how to kill Russians. That's Gorka humor. Follow this man at Ilan Berman on Twitter. Also, ilanberman.com. He's the senior vice president of the American Foreign Policy Council. This is America First One-on-One. If you enjoy these long form, deep dive interviews that you really don't get anywhere else with the true experts, with the newsmakers, make sure you never miss an episode. Subscribe today. It's absolutely free. Go to your favorite podcast platform. Go to Spotify. Plug in my name. Plug in America First. Subscribe. Write us a review. It helps with those dastardly things, those algorithms, and share the links with everybody you know and never miss an episode. If you haven't done so already, be sure to register right now for our Stand With Israel tour 10 days later this year. With like-minded conservatives, you're going to get to hang out in the Holy Land with not just little old me, but the director of 2,000 Mules. Yes, Dinesh D'Souza and his lovely wife Debbie will be joining us for the trip of a lifetime. Even if you've been to Israel before, you haven't been with me and Dinesh. We're going to be standing right there where our Lord and Savior stood, on the shores of the Sea of Galilee, on the Temple Mount, at the Garden of Gethsemane. Don't hesitate. Register today. You do not want to miss this trip. You can call right now to reserve your seats, 855-565-5519, or just go to standwithisraeltour.com. That number again, 855-565-5519, or standwithisraeltour.com. Dear friends, you know my friend Mike Lindell has a passion to help everyone get the best sleep of their lives. He didn't stop by simply creating the best pillow. Now Mike has done it again by introducing his My Slippers. For a limited time, you'll get $90 off a pair of My Slippers. This blowout sale of the year won't last, so order now. They took over 2 years to develop. They're designed to wear indoor and out. I've already worn out my first pair of My Slippers, and they're made with the same amazing My Pillow foam and impact gel to help prevent fatigue, and lined with real suede. Call 800-829-8468. Use promo code Gorka for that massive discount, or just go to mypillow.com and click on the radio listener square and put in the secret code GORKA. This offer won't last long. You won't regret it. They are the best slippers I have ever owned. And $90 off mypillow.com. Do it today. Promo code GORKA. Okay, before we get into I could do this for hours with you, Ilan. Let's talk about the exigencies of warfare. War is about maps, okay? If you can't read a map, you're not going to understand warfare. Right now, the burning strategic challenge, to put it mildly, for Ukraine is to stop Russia taking Odessa and linking it to Mariupol in a land bridge which will effectively make one of the largest nations in Europe a landlocked country, meaning it cannot export anything the way it used to export by the sea. Is that close to happening? First, do you concur? Is it close to happening? How significant a threat is that for Kiev?
Well, that was always the Russian plan, right? The idea, if you go on Google and you Google Novorossiya, right, New Russia, you see all these fairly arresting, thankfully, sort of not actual images, but fairly arresting representations of what Vladimir Putin wants
The fantasy, Vlad's fantasies.
Right, and that is precisely what you said, which is to create a corridor that extends, like a jutting lower lip, extends for the Russian Federation into... links up with, as Putin thought he was going to, links up with Russian Ukrainians of Russian extraction, Russian sympathizers, and creates a situation where the Russian Federation occupies all of the south of Ukraine. And by the way, as it creeps further and further west in the Kremlin imagination, you can begin to imagine things like linking up with other enclaves, like the enclave of Transnistria in Moldova.
Or not just enclaves. If you, it's always rule number one of warfare: listen to what the enemy says. If you read or listen to the translations of Putin's speeches, right, he has said, just as he posits Ukraine being illegitimate, a non-nation, he said the same thing about the Baltics. He's even said the same thing about NATO nation Poland.
No, and that's exactly right. And that's a fascinating point. And we talked about this earlier. The idea that Vladimir Putin is not a Soviet aspirant. He's not somebody who's trying to recreate the Soviet Union. In fact, in his speeches, he reserves a lot of vitriol for Lenin, because he thinks Lenin was, in your words, too woke, right? Lenin created this federated structure that provided too much autonomy to all these different ethnicities.
Giving national identity autonomies, exactly. And then Khrushchev recognizes Crimea. He's right. A weakling as well.
Exactly.
I am the new czar. Not a Soviet
right.
leader, but the czar of the neo-imperialist Russia.
Which I think, by the way, for American policymakers is really very difficult to understand. The idea that you now have in charge in Russia a leader who believes the Soviet Union was a little bit too much of a politically correct model, and it afforded too much power.
That sentence, let's repeat that. The Soviet Union, with its gulags, was a too politically correct version of Russia.
Right.
Stunning.
Absolutely, in Vladimir Putin's imagination, because it afforded to all these ethnicities, to all these what Putin would call artificial nation states, the idea that they were real states, that they were real ethnicities. And in his conception, there's nothing like that. All the boundaries are erased. All you have is the Russian Empire. And the seat of the Russian Empire, the seat from which the Russian Empire sprang in antiquity, was called Kievan Rus, which has as its center the modern nation state, the territory of the modern nation state of Ukraine.
Which the irony of which is, if you really understand, if you want to make historic arguments of, you know, who came first, right. It should be Ukraine taking over Russia, right? Because, right. you know, right. the Rus land comes out of what is
Kiev and Rus.
Yeah. Rus.
That's right.
And Russia and the Duchy of Muscovy comes much later than
Absolutely.
Ukraine.
Absolutely. And this is why, and this is, I think, a very important point, because I've talked about this a lot with fellow academics and think tankers, and there's really not a lot of understanding about why Russia cares so much about Ukraine, right? Why Ukraine really occupies, why Ukraine is, as the kids say, living rent-free in Vladimir Putin's head.
Right.
But the reason is because Ukraine is the wellspring from which the Russian imperial impulse sprang. Without Ukraine, without Kievan Rus, there's no Russian Empire.
Right.
So you cannot be a new Russian Empire without subjugating Ukraine today.
It's like Pepsi saying, we are Coca-Cola, right? No, seriously.
Right.
It's the latter brand that is built upon the popularity
right.
of a progenitor trying to steal the authenticity right. of the progenitor.
Right. No, no.
Trying to be American about it.
Right. Well, I think that's right. I'm not sure if that analogy is exact, but I think the thought is exactly right, which is that the Russian Empire, as Putin conceives of it today, sort of this neo-imperial sphere of influence, doesn't actually exist in the absence of a sort of a whole series of countries that are now countries, real
right.
countries, that accept him as a sovereign. And increasingly, you're seeing that the opposite of that is happening.
And as somebody else put it, if you want to have a Russian Empire, you can't have it with Ukraine. You've got to have that breadbasket. There's, you know, a rump Russia without
right.
Ukraine. With Ukraine, you can talk about being an empire. Talk to us about the significance of this land in terms of economics, in
right.
terms of agriculture. People forget that, for example, 60% of the wheat that makes the bread in
right.
Egypt comes from Ukraine. The last Egyptian government fell because of
right.
bread prices. So people think, Ukraine, far away, who cares? It's kind of Russia, isn't it, anyway? But this is a nation that provides so much to so many that if it becomes landlocked, that's not a geopolitical crisis we can stay out of.
No, and absolutely right. And I think that's the sleeper issue, the issue that most people aren't focusing on, the food security issue, because the ripples of the Ukraine war are going to extend far beyond Ukraine in terms of the disruption that you have to global markets. I was in the Middle East a few days before the war started, and I remember looking at grain prices and commodity prices there. And I was struck by the fact, I was in Israel, and I was struck by the fact that already Israeli politicians, Israeli analysts were worried about what this might do, what this disruption of grain supply might do to Israeli consumption of bread and cereal and things like that, things that aren't super sexy.
Or
but
the neighborhood.
But absolutely. But this is precisely the point. Israel is a first world economy. They are resilient. They are stable. They can weather because of the average cost of living, they can weather the a hike in grain prices.
Unlike
Egypt,
right.
Unlike Lebanon, unlike Tunisia.
And we're talking about not a small nation of a few million. We're talking about nations of tens of hundreds of millions who suddenly will wake up one morning and not be able to afford bread. That is how global crises are born. We're talking to Ilan Berman. Follow him at Ilan Berman, also at the American Foreign Policy Council. Don't forget all of our social media, Seb Gorka, Twitter, Truth Social, you name it. And don't forget Rumble, where we live stream, rumble.com/Seb Gorka. It is shocking to see, so excited, such an amazing testament to the work of Dinesh D'Souza, Catherine Engelbrecht, Greg Phillips, that this movie that was made independently, produced by Salem, the 2000 Mules documentary, is now in 415 theaters across America. 415. The most popular, successful documentary of its kind in a decade. More than 1 million downloads in 6 days. More than 100,000 DVDs mailed out already on Rotten Tomatoes. Yes, I know it's pop culture. It now has a 100% viewer rating. You need to go and see it either in a movie theater or stream it or order the DVD. I am so intrigued and so overwhelmed by the work that they have done. I have a vested interest. I have a financial stake in this film because it is the proof we need with regards to the greatest heist in American history. Watch it today, salemnow.com. That's salemnow.com. Ilan, we've talked about the danger of a landlocked Ukraine. Let's talk about our actions to date. I've said $40 billion worth of aid doesn't make a lot of sense in terms of cash to Kiev, especially when it has line items for $7 billion for the State Department, an undisclosed amount of money for the CIA. That doesn't look like aid to Kiev. Having spoken to Kremlinologists, people who've worked in the Ukraine, what they need is what Zelensky's calling for, which is weapons, which is weaponry, ammunition, wheeled vehicles to move their troops, and also training of their reserves in safe locales like the Baltics and Poland. Will you give us your assessment of the West en bloc's response to this war in the last 3 months?
Right. Well, I mean, there's a lot there to unpack, but I think generally I'm positive on the Western response. I do have some of the same misgivings as you, which is because our politics, I may say charitably, have become intolerably stupid.
Ours.
No,
America's.
Ours, not ours. America's politics.
DC's. Right.
There is this false equation that if you somehow question the line items in the $40 billion, that you are not,
you're on Putin's side.
You're on Putin's side, or you're somehow not supportive enough of Ukraine. But the more nuanced argument is, I firmly believe sunlight is the best disinfectant. I want to see what's sort of what is allocated, whether it's actually going to be useful to Ukraine.
And accountability.
Absolutely.
But can I just flip on that stupid politics?
Yeah.
There's also the flip side of that, that if you're pro, as we are, supporting what I see as Ukraine 1776, suddenly you're an interventionist neocon.
That's right.
This is nuts.
And that isn't true either.
Right.
I think the center of gravity, and I think you'll agree with me, I think the center of gravity of any aid that we give, that our European allies give, has to be robust enough and effective enough to stand down the Russians and to create the breathing room that Ukraine needs to succeed.
I've used harsh language in everything I've written or said. I've said aid we give to Kiev should have one purpose, to make Russians bleed, to make those in uniform who are executing the mission of this mass murderer now, because you can say that.
Absolutely.
Make them bleed, make them hurt, whether it's weaponry, whether it's intelligence, help the Ukrainians win this war. I think it's a very simple metric.
No, I think you're right. But what I don't like is the idea that you have a large aid package that resembles a lot the old Nancy Pelosi canard of you have to pass it in order to find out what's in it.
Right.
I don't think that's a good way to do defense allocations. I do think that we really need to listen to the Ukrainians and listen to what they're actually asking for.
Yeah. As opposed to having promised something via Poland, such as the backfilling of Soviet jets given to Ukraine, and then having somebody in the Pentagon say, We think Ukraine doesn't need that. I think probably when Ukraine says they do, they perhaps the person on the front line knows better what they need.
No, absolutely. But I think all of this needs to be balanced against the realization, which the other side doesn't understand, is that our allocation of effective defensive aid is not us itching for a fight with the Russians. It's us understanding that if Putin is not deterred now, we're going to need to deter him later.
Right. So this is Crenshaw's stupid tweet that, you know, this is how we defeat Russia. No. It's how we stop the first domino falling.
Correct. And because, you know, we were talking about history, it's useful to remember that Russia is approaching all of this encroachment on its former holdings, right? Because let's be clear, it thinks of it as its former holdings.
Yeah. Soviet territory is ours.
Is ours, and will in perpetuity will be ours. It thinks of it as a multi-course meal. It seizes, it eats, it digests, and it comes back for seconds. Yeah. And it's been doing that since, well, the mid-2000s, right? Because you had the cyber attack against Estonia, you had the war with Georgia, which also lopped off semi-autonomous parts of territory. You had the occupation and annexation of Crimea in 2014, and now you have what's happening in the east of Ukraine, in the Donbass. Right. And so the idea that this has not happened before is frankly ahistoric. Right. The Russians have an established pattern of behavior. The only question for us is whether or not we have enough skin in the game to prevent another course from coming.
Right. That's the big question. As President Trump said in his, I think, his most important speech, the speech in Warsaw, the question for the West is, do we have the will to fight and defeat those who wish to destroy us because of the value systems of the Judeo-Christian system? I'm Sebastian Gorka. This is America First, coming to you from the ReliefFactor.com studios. So let's talk about Putin and scenarios. As far as I'm concerned, there's no negotiated off-ramp because he right. wants Ukraine. He wants the Balts. He wants all these breakaway republics. He wants Poland. So the way you stop this is by making it impossible for him to go further.
Right.
So the latest reports out of Kiev, no, we're not negotiating. We are fighting for free Ukraine. God bless them. Let's talk about inside Russia.
Sure.
Allegedly, he had some cancer operation. He's been arresting people left, right, and center. He doesn't look too healthy. He's not a crazy guy. This is what KGB colonels do. When it comes to scenarios inside Russia, has he effectively destroyed, killed, or imprisoned any resistance? And if there is a quote-unquote regime change, it's only going to come from people who are already inside the Kremlin or the general staff, is it not?
Right. Well, so there's two things there, right? So the first question is, if there is some sort of political transition in Russia, what kind will it be? And we all hope that it is the Russian people rising up, but I mean,
to be a democracy like they've never ever been.
Absolutely. But like they've never had in history.
Yeah.
In a country that spans 9 separate time zones.
Bingo.
So the idea is a good one, and I think it's a laudable one. But there's many a slip between cup and lip. And so you have politicians like Alexei Navalny, who are really galvanizing increasingly the young cohort in the country to start to worry about things like corruption, to worry about things like transparency.
There have been protests, but they've been brutalized.
They have, and they've been isolated, which is, you know, when you have cities with protests in the Russian Far East, this is many time zones and many hundreds of thousands of miles away from actually affecting change. Right. And so you have I think you have an agency problem, right, with regard to the Russian opposition. The most likely regime change, if it does happen, is actually from within the cohort that surrounds Putin.
Now, some have said that, oh, it's going to be the oligarchs because the oligarchs right. don't like their yachts being taken away. But people don't understand how the oligarchs became the oligarchs.
Right.
The oligarchs became the oligarchs because Putin said, you don't ask me how I got here. I want to ask you about your first million. I mean, they're not there, but for Putin. So the idea that an oligarch is suddenly going to take him down, isn't it more likely to be members of the Siloviki or the say the official establishment, not the oligarchs, right. and we're just going to do like a Caesar, we're going to take him out.
So right. So not to wax too academic, but I think that's absolutely right, because if you look historically over the instances of regime change in the 20th century, and there've been a lot of them, the average regime change, if you could call it that, is not a authoritarian to democratic transition.
Yeah, right.
It's actually an authoritarian to authoritarian transition.
It's the you know, one member of the old guard
exactly.
taking out another member of the old guard.
Right. And that, I think, that leads me directly to my second point, which is that I think we structurally have a Russia problem in the way we think about Russia. Because we know that Russian institutions are famously corrupt. We know that the force ministries, the Siloviki, the intelligence services, those professionals have infiltrated and permeated all of the structures that could potentially ever lead to a democratic Russia.
Right.
But we have personalized our understanding of Russia to such an extent that if Vladimir Putin does leave the scene, you know that the next minute there'll be conversations about normalizing Russia, allowing Russia to re-enter the global community of nations.
Which is exactly what happened with Gorbachev and Yeltsin.
That's right.
We looked at them as these saviors of U.S.-Russian relations, when in fact they were neither.
Right. And that's why, that's where I think the danger for Putin as a person comes from. Because the crowd that surrounds him, the Siloviki, the enforcers, the people who are in positions of power, understand very well that their system, the system that brought them to power, that elevated them, that made them famously rich, will remain intact if only this troublesome individual is removed, right? They're banking on the idea that we won't look behind the curtain and look at the fact that the Russian government, as currently constituted, is really a problem and a drag on international security. We're just going to be thankful that Putin is gone. And sadly, I think they're probably correct.
We've got to address one issue that comes up again and again and again and is kind of unsubtly used by the Kremlin, that's nuclear weapons.
Sure.
Now, in comparison to the Cold War, yeah, the control is far looser. It used to be Communist Party and Politburo, very tight reins on nuclear weapons. Communist Party doesn't exist anymore. The control is in the armed forces. But the idea that this is a crazy man who's going to, you know, nuke Kiev, this is a posturing act. It's not a scenario he's considering, or is it?
Well, I think really that's a $64,000 question. I am not sure that I am comfortable wagering even one life on the idea that I could be wrong. But my sense is what yours is, which is that the Russians, and before them the Soviets, were very good at gaming Western strategy, at creating what we still recall was called the balance of terror. The idea
right.
that they would hold our populations at risk and constrain the way we reacted to them. Why? Because, well, Western countries tend to value the lives of their citizens more than the Soviets did. And therefore, they could get away with a lot by targeting what they call counter value, right? Cities, population centers, things that we value.
Yeah.
And my sense is that's really the thinking today. The worry that Western leaders have over a Russian utilization of nuclear weapons, tactical nuclear weapons, theater nuclear weapons, what have you, is propelling some of what we talked about earlier, this idea that you have to give Putin an off-ramp. You have to create a face-saving measure for him to step down from this war. And if we don't, bad consequences will ensue. They may, but it's also a calculation that's baked into everything that Putin is doing.
Right.
He is expecting that reaction from
right.
us.
If you want more on this, this is actually a quasi-theological item in Soviet doctrine. It's called reflexive control. It's understanding your adversary's pressure points and what they are most sensitive to and driving them down a certain decision tree based upon their sensitivities. There's some great writing on this. Tim Thomas out of Fort Leavenworth, I talk about it in my second book, Why We Fight. Look up reflexive control in Why We Fight and also Tim Thomas. We're talking to Ilan Berman. This is America First, coming to you from the Relief Factor .com studios. So you said something about how we've personalized our understanding. We have the wrong metrics or the wrong prism through which to even begin to understand Russia. If there were a new administration, if it were a robust administration that let's just leave it at that, a robust administration. What would be the first thing that Ilan Berman would recommend, or the first two things that should be done differently in terms of understanding today's Russia,
right.
yesterday's Russia, tomorrow's Russia?
Right. Well, I think we're sort of, you know, the administration is coming to these conclusions as a result of what it's seeing on
the kicking and screaming, being dragged to those conclusions. Sort of,
reality is a harsh mistress, right? No, but I think it's precisely what the administration has learned over the last several weeks of watching the Russians fight. It is that Russia is, in essence, at its core, an expansionist endeavor.
Yeah.
They believe, truly, deeply believe that they're destined to be an empire, that they have an imperial calling, and they want to expand their borders outward. And they will do so, even against adverse conditions, unless there is some sort of break on their expansionism. And that break, our politicians may talk about things like climate change, may talk about things like international institutions, but the most effective break on Russian expansionism has been visual images, arresting visual images of our willingness to supply free peoples with the weapons to stand them down.
Yeah. It's they look at this expansionist mandate paradoxically as a mode of defense. It's also manifest destiny, right? We must be an expanding empire. And also, this is how we defend against those who wish to encircle us, is by expanding and taking other people's territory, correct?
It's this very strange bad neighbor problem, right? When you have a bad neighbor who constantly, doesn't mow his lawn or doesn't take out the trash or, throws trash all over his driveway, and then he yells at you for the perceived wrong that you're doing by calling attention to it.
Yes.
Right? So you have this weird situation where the Russians for years have railed against NATO expansion, right? The idea that NATO is expanding, that they have a sense of siege.
That free countries shouldn't be allowed to join the club of free countries.
Right. And yet they create the military conditions that propel free countries to join NATO.
Which is the beautiful irony of the last 3 weeks, if 3 months, if anything can be said about it that is beautiful, that by using this dogma, they've actually encouraged erstwhile neutral nations like Finland and Sweden to actually join that club of free nations. I could go on for hours. Educate yourself. Follow this man. Get the book Implosion, The End of Russia and What It Means for America. Follow him, Ilan Berman, on Twitter, ilanberman.com, and the American Foreign Policy Council, afpc.org. I'm Sebastian Gorka. This has been America First One-on-One. Wherever you are, whatever you're doing, keep your head on a swivel. Watch your six, hold the line, never give up, never give in, and stay frosty.
Our fathers brought forth upon this continent a new nation, conceived in liberty and dedicated to the proposition that all men are created equal.
I know not what course others may take, but as for me, give me liberty or give me death.
The world will little note or long remember what we say here, but it can never forget what they did here.
I have a dream. Ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country.
Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall.
I can hear you. The rest of the world hears you. Yes. And the people... and the people who knocked these buildings down will hear all of us soon.
And we will make America great again.
This is America First with Sebastian Gorka.
This is about as clear evidence you could find of intent by the campaign to collude with the Russians, to get useful information from the Russians.
I think there's plenty of evidence of collusion or conspiracy in plain sight.
I did say that there is ample evidence, and indeed there is, of collusion of people in the Trump campaign with the Russians.
He is going to be delivering what I think are going to be his indictments, the final indictments.
I would not be surprised if there were a number of indictments that still were going to come down the pike.
There are indictments in this president's future.
And I think they're shocked that the noose is tightening.
He feels the noose is tightening.
The noose is tightening.
The sound of hoofbeats of all those investigations catching up with Donald Trump must be loud in his ears.
Hmm. He may be the first president in quite some time to face the real prospect of jail time.
People might go to jail
You're exactly right.
For the rest of their lives.
I think they're all going to jail.
Well, I think they're all going to end up together in prison, and maybe that's a good thing.
Oh, my God.
He has no idea that he's going down.
You're confident that at least some Trump associates will wind up in jail?
If I was betting, I would say yes.
That's what you were told for 4 years incessantly. And in fact, a large chunk of the American population still believes that that is the case, that the Russian Federation, the Kremlin, Vladimir Putin, somehow colluded with the duly elected president of the United States, or that Russia somehow helped that man win the election. Let's listen to some more recent cuts. Just two, one from a liberal left-wing attorney, a learned individual, and one from my former Fox colleague, another lawyer, Greg Jarrett. This is first Jonathan Turley talking about the recent revelations regarding the Russia hoax, the Sussman trial, and John Durham's special counsel investigation. Cut 10.
And what's really, really quite breathtaking in this case is that Hillary Clinton greenlighted the release of this claim, even though the campaign was told that there are serious problems with what they were alleging. But she greenlighted it and then told the public something that was pretty much untrue, right? She went on to Twitter and said, hey, Slate just ran a story that there's this connection through Alpha Bank. She and Jake Sullivan, now the national security advisor, basically pretended to the public that this was all news to them and that they were breathless at this new disclosure when the campaign created this scandal.
That is the recent revelation just last week in a court, sworn testimony from Robbie Mook, one of Hillary Clinton's top campaign managers, stating that she authorized, she knew about, she authorized the smear dossier and its dissemination to the press. An act that afterwards she tweeted out as if she had nothing to do with it and said, oh my, look at this accusation in the press. Jake Sullivan, her foreign policy advisor, did the same. The same Jake Sullivan who happens to be today Biden's national security advisor. But that's just half of the scandal, really. That a political party, that its presidential nominee, lied to the FBI and tried to have her opponent smeared in the mainstream media. The other half is what the establishment did with that smear and with that story. Here is Chief Legal Analyst for Fox News, another truth teller, Greg Jarrett, cut 9.
And it should be especially disgraceful to Mueller and his 19 prosecutors that they either didn't know that Hillary Clinton invented all of it, or they knew it and covered it up.
There's only two options. If you understand rhetoric, logic, and factual reasoning, the 40 people working, the agents, the lawyers, the investigators working for that former FBI director who wanted to be the FBI director again under the President Trump's administration, either they didn't know what has now been sworn to in a court of law, that the Russia collusion accusation was an artificial, made-up smear funded by the Clinton campaign and funneled through a former MI6 intelligence officer. Either they didn't know, which means they're incompetent, or they did know and they covered it up. Dear friends, I'm Sebastian Gorka. This is America First. And just the last 7 minutes is all the evidence you know or you need to know that this constitutes the largest scandal, as we here at Salem call it, the biggest heist in American history. 64 million Americans chose an outsider, an individual who'd never run for political office before. Why? because they'd had enough with the swamp. They'd had enough with the professional political class on either side of the aisle that had betrayed them, betrayed the working class, the heart of America, whether it was with deals concerning China, outsourcing millions of jobs to that communist regime, or whether it's the backroom deals, whether it's the pork-filled bills that were written by special interest groups, by lobbyists, to create not really a free market system, but really a system in which the richest and the biggest corporations try to create conditions that benefit them to the detriment of real free market practitioners. Because that man didn't belong to the swamp, because nobody owned him, no special interest group could tell him what to do, because he was in fact a self-made man, an outsider, a contractor, a builder, and, with his reality TV show, an incredibly successful popular culture figure, 17 seasons of The Apprentice being the most successful show of its kind. He walks into the White House, and there's no lobbying group, there's no union, there's no dark money interest that can control him, that can call him up and say, oh, we need you to do this for us, Donald. Oh, and remember that money we gave you 2 years ago, 5 years ago, when you were starting your political career? Well, now it's payback. We need this line, we need this paragraph to be inserted into the next bill that Mitch McConnell brings before the Senate. Will you do that and then sign it into law for us? Nobody can tell President Trump to do that. And that's why he had to be destroyed. When he was so successful that he created the most powerful economy America had ever seen and the world had ever seen, he had to be stopped. And that's why the Russia hoax. While Hillary was colluding with Russia, using a Russian smear dossier from a Russian working at the Brookings Institution in D.C., whilst her husband was getting $500,000 for a 40-minute speech in Moscow from the same company that was buying 20% of America's uranium, which is illegal. Yeah. A man was running the country who wasn't controlled by the establishment on left and right. And that's why we need him or somebody very much like him. And I don't see anybody out there who can fill a stadium like he does in 24 hours back in the White House. So 2024, it's up to us. He's going to run. Are we going to make sure he wins? Ask yourself, what are you doing about it? I'm Sebastian Gorka. This is America First. Make sure you are subscribed to the podcast. Go to Spotify, punch in my name, Sebastian Gorka, America First. Subscribe. It's absolutely free. Guarantee you never miss an episode. Write a review. It helps. And share the links. Next, a former member of the Trump administration.
Three-star general Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, deliver the truth, whatever the cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, deliver the truth, whatever the cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.